Gonna take a sip of water before doing the standard intro. Okay.
Sounded refreshing.
Yes. It does not sound refreshing over the recording, though, if we leave them in. It just sounds gross.
Hello. Welcome to Foss and Crafts,
a podcast about free software, free culture, and making things together.
With my co-host, Morgan.
And my co-host, Chris. And this week, we have our first kind of listener suggestion for an interview. Listener Schluffinger Schluff on Mastodon suggested that we do an interview with Vicky Steves, and we absolutely agreed. So here we are. So welcome, Vicky.
Hi, thanks so much for having me. Thanks again, Schluff, for requesting me.
Well, we looked at your, I think I've actually been subscribed to you on the Fediverse for quite a while, but
me as well.
But once I pulled up your profile again, I'm like, oh, right, of course, this is a perfect person to have on the show. So, I mean, I guess there's a lot of reasons to say why,
maybe you should let her introduce herself.
Yeah, I suppose that makes sense. So, Vicky, would you like to introduce yourself to our audience?
Yeah, sure. Hi, everyone. I'm Vicky Steves. I'm a big fan of both Foss and Crafts, so I do feel very happy and that I'm an appropriate guest for this podcast. I work at an academic library, and my job there is around encouraging open and reproducible research. And I typically like teach classes and walk people through the process to make their work more reproducible as a part of my job. I also have studied different open source communities, specifically in academia, as a part of a project called Ice Age. And I've been crafting since I could hold things in my hands. So very happy to be here.
Well, excellent. We're happy to have you here. I have also been crafting since I could hold things in my hands. That was kind of a staple of my childhood.
Yeah, for sure.
So, to start off with, would you like to talk a little bit about how you incorporate Foss and open research as a research librarian?
Yeah, so like I said, a lot of my job is teaching and walking people through different like processes for their research. Some of it is like, how do you publish data? But some of it is more of that nitty gritty. How do you use Git to help you collaborate on a group project? Things like that. So I only will teach using open source tools because the majority of the folks that I see at my library are typically students of all levels, particularly graduate students, though. And I want them to be able to use whatever best practices that I'm teaching them after they leave my university, which is pretty well funded. So they have access to a lot of software through the library and other providers on campus that they will definitely lose access to very shortly after graduation. So I use open source as a way to teach sustainable skills to students. And I also encourage their use within our own library systems. Libraries have always been big makers and consumers of open source. And that certainly factors into, our internal processes, what products we choose to support in our library space, things like that. So open is everywhere. It's a big part of my job.
That's amazing. That's something I also have encountered in my studies, is a lot of universities have these big contracts with proprietary software companies to use kind of the big flashy things. And then as a student, either you can only have access to them in a computer lab, or you get a student subscription to it while you're a student, and then you graduate and you can't use any of those tools anymore.
Yeah, it's a huge problem. And, you know, I want people to use their time and university resources wisely. And you know, I'm a university researcher, I'm a service provider, and it's definitely factored heavily into the way that I provide a service to my community. The other big way it factors in, not just sort of for the efficiency and benefits to individual researchers, I also care a lot about it from a memory perspective. So how do I make sure that their scholarship is preserved in the long term when it's, you know, a piece of software, for example, or a data set that goes along with a paper or a thesis or a claim. So I also approach openness from that perspective as well. And I think, you know, the more open, the more likely it will be preserved. That's just a fact for a lot of reasons, copyright, technology-wise. Yeah.
So this is actually interesting. I think we have a tie-in with a previous episode. So we had on Stefano Zaccaroli from Software Heritage.
Yay, Zach.
Yes, Zach is great. And he was talking about the way that Software Heritage is increasingly playing a role in reproducible research and software preservation. So I'm happy to see a continuing thread. I'm suspecting that, I mean, his work is primarily from the perspective of providing the service that keeps the software alive. So I'm assuming that from your perspective as a research librarian, you're working on a different angle of the problem. Is that right?
There's two sides to preservation, right? There's the actual preservation, which it tends to be, we think of it as back of the house type of a job. You know, it's forward migration of different formats or emulation in some case. There's a great project for software actually called Emulation as a Service Infrastructure. And it's all about providing access to emulated software collections from libraries. It's very cool. And so there's also that access piece that is just as important as the preservation part. So I definitely come at it from both angles there. I care not only about, you know, can you actually see the code, but how can future patrons, future users rerun it, interact with it, extend it in the same way that, you know, you might look at past data for longitude studies or for a basis for your own work now. I'm interested in providing that basis to future scholars. So yeah, it definitely is. So software mission is so important for just the continuation of research and so central to long-term reproducibility. I think I've seen a lot of researchers be content, like saying, I have a Docker file, my work is reproducible, when there's actually so much more work that goes into keeping that code rerunnable and even like knowing the workflow of your research of process as so important to understanding even the outputs of what people are seeing. You know, it all ties together.
Yeah. So I think you've hit a strong point there with the, so I guess not everybody might be familiar with Docker, but I'm going to try to give a summary for the unfamiliar potentially. Docker is a way of basically kind of rolling up a whole set of software that's related to the software that somebody wants to run, like all of the pieces, so that and it kind of gets handed to you as kind of a black box, which like can be useful to be able to hand somebody a black box thing that appears to just work, right? But it sounds like from your perspective, that's insufficient because you're not getting somebody to the point of how did you build that black box, right?
Yeah, well, so there's a few issues with using containers for reproducibility, or I guess I should say long-term reproducibility, because I think in the short term, containers actually probably are fine. But if we want any longer sustained access to materials, they fall short in a number of ways. One is just that the technology isn't super reliable. Like there was one period for a few years where Docker just didn't work on Windows Home Edition. And so, you know, students would come to me with a lot of problems related to Docker on Windows Home Edition. I would have to tell them, you kind of just have to, you know, install a VM and do your work that way. But there's also the idea of provenance. Like you can give someone a Docker file and a repository full of scripts, but if there's not any like accompanying documentation about which scripts to run first, where the input data is, they can have lots of missing pieces. So there's actually quite a few components that go into making something reproducible in the long term. A lot of it has to do with documentation and sort of best practices of using good, sustainable file formats for your data, like CSVs instead of Excel files.
Yeah.
And also sort of keeping track of the environment you're using in a little bit more of a sustainable way than a Docker file. And there are a few different projects that address this. Like I work on one, it's an open source tool called ReproZip. There's also Occam, which is a project by my friend Wilkie, who's also on the FETI. I don't know if either of you have ever interacted with Wilkie.
I definitely know Wilkie. Wilkie was involved in the social web working group where we standardized ActivityPub.
Yeah, there you go. So Wilkie works on a software preservation project in service of reproducibility. So we work closely together in that issue. So it's been very cool to see sort of the open source community galvanize around this problem of preservation and access to materials in the long term.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we've touched on this a couple of times, but you say on your website that you like to facilitate the use of open in all facets of research. And a lot of us are familiar with, well, especially the listeners of this podcast, probably with things like open source and open access and things like that. But how do you apply that more broadly?
Yeah, so there are a lot of different components of a given research project that are really necessary to keep it understandable. And I really think by opening up those different, facets, our research will be more sustainable and more understandable and more easier to extend. So I think of particularly publishing like lab protocols. There are a few different websites where folks have been publishing their protocols and soliciting peer review and reuse of them and actually getting citations for their lab protocols. And they're doing that to have an open methodology. There are pre-registrations, which is basically you register your methodology in advance openly so that when it comes time to report on the outcome of your work, you avoid the problem of what's called hypothesizing after results are known, harking. Mm-hmm. So it's basically like you saw the data and you sort of shifted your claim a little bit about it. So we're seeing some movement in open methodologies, which I think is particularly important. So that type of thing is something that I want to encourage along with opening up your source code. Academics tend to, or in academia, folks tend to open up everything but that underlying material. Like the focus tends to be on an article and increasingly on data sets and code. But I think there's still a lot of room for improvement in that area.
Yeah, I think that that's something that I've definitely encountered before as well. The idea that if you make all of your research or your findings public, then what are you going to publish later? And what happens if someone else takes that and publishes it again? So it's a bit of a hard hurdle to overcome sometimes, because academics have kind of got this whole publish or perish thing drilled into us.
Yeah, and I find it pretty funny, to be honest, when I hear stuff like that, because it makes me think like someone is going to see your data or your whatever it is you're publishing, your methodology, maybe it's going to be so great in detail that they're going to have the exact same idea as you, and then they're going to publish the exact same paper you are going to publish. Like there's so many what ifs to that scenario, so many things that have to perfectly fall in line for that to actually come to fruition,
and they're going to really finish it before you.
Exactly. Well, but it presupposes so much.
So I haven't been around in free and open source software forever, but I've been around since I started in I think maybe around 2001-ish. And that was right around the time that I think the hype around open source was really starting to snowball. And at that time, I remember basically between 2001 and 2005, it was a constant question from people who were new to the idea of that it's pretty much all the stuff that you two were just discussing, right? Like this, somebody's going to swap and swipe it away from you. They're going to blah, blah, blah. And a lot of those things are things that people don't even really bring up anymore. Like those aren't the concerns, maybe concerns about, how we're going to fund it and stuff like that. But people are not afraid that you're going to be upended in your ability to participate by having released things in an open way. So I wonder if this might just be kind of growing pains.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I definitely think so. I think again, with open access to manuscripts being such the focus of the open community in the academic world, open access to manuscripts is actually about 40% of scholarship is open access now. Like there have been really noticeable gains in that area. And I am really eager to continue to push that for data code methodology. The other side to these myths too is that if you publish it openly and someone doesn't cite it, there are real concerns about academic misconduct. and not showing your sources, or in some cases, you know, plagiarism concerns too. So yeah, I definitely think like there are some myths that are going to be shed as we continue to build community and build technology around data and code sharing. And particularly in the reproducibility space, we've seen an outgrowth of, you know, for-profit companies who have taken open tools by the community, packaged them and resold them in, you know, which so many folks do. And this is also something that I think is going to be a big issue in particularly this open movement for code and data. Because a lot of these vendors for, you know, these reproducibility software will often say you have to work within our platform to be able to make sure your work is reproducible. And that's already a pretty high barrier. And that's already, I think, pretty unstable. So, yeah, there's a lot of churn around this community lately. But there are also some really strong leaders and some really strong community and open source tools that I think folks have really been steadily adopting. Like, it's cool to see Project Jupiter grow so much.
You work with the academic community, but I understand that you've also done academic work studying the open source community and maybe how these two communities intersect. Is that correct?
Yeah, so I worked on a Sloan-funded project called Investigating and Archiving the Scholarly Git Experience, which is super long. I don't know why Josh let me get away with that, my program officer, but we shortened it to Ice Age. Shout out to Genevieve and Sarah, who were my two compatriots on that study. That whole project was basically to understand two things, one of which is what we call GLAM community, galleries, libraries, archives, and museums, best preserve research software in a way that's contextually meaningful, like capturing all that documentation and dependency information that would be so key to giving access to the software in the future. And then there's also the sort of behavioral study side where we looked at how academics are using Git for various what we called scholarly activities. So whether that's for methods tracking, so people using a GitHub repository as like a lab notebook, or whether it's for publication, people sharing whole, like, I know the DH community shares a lot of their projects on GitHub. It's pretty common to use it as a publishing platform as well. So we studied the ways that these communities have formed, where the pain points are in using these tools, so where people are having trouble adopting Git and version control into their workflow, and getting a feel for how it's used too.
Did you dog food your approach here? As in, is your data for this study reproducible and something our listeners could check out?
Absolutely. So we just published our data in the qualitative data repository. So there are focus groups, a survey, and interviews. All of our survey analysis code is in a GitLab repository, which people are more, it's under an MIT license. Our data is under a Creative Commons license. So I would definitely invite anybody to go digging through our data and do something cool and interesting with it. I have so many research ideas I just want to give away about this particular data set. So.
Cool. We can put the links to that in our show notes. So Morgan, it strikes me that some of the stuff that Vicky's saying here sounds familiar to some of the issues that you've encountered both from other academics, but also with kind of becoming a digital humanities person. Is that right?
Yeah. So I have mentioned before that I've been involved in a digital humanities project, and it started several years before I joined the project, and there had already been, I think, two other graduate students working on it, and the primary researcher who, the professor who was the primary researcher on it, and a couple of, actually not a couple, and an entire undergraduate class that contributed to the project as part of their coursework. So when I came into it, there were already files being shared for it in a number of different platforms. And so for that project, we had files on Dropbox, on Box, on Google Docs, on GitHub, and I think there were like multiple Dropbox things.
But wait, the primary one was over email, right?
Was over email, yes. Which obviously is a horrible way to do version control because it's really hard to find things.
Yeah.
And I introduced GitHub to the project, and then after I stopped being the primary person working on the project, the people who took up work after me did not continue using GitHub, which is partially because I was doing web development and actually writing code, and they were doing more development of content. But still, that just meant that there were more kind of decentralized, but not in a good way, places that this information was stored.
Yeah, that's actually a huge part of my job, is going into like different lab groups and research groups and sort of helping them organize everything in a way that's not only would be understandable to like new students coming on and off the project. Knowledge management is actually a big part of reproducible research, even within one's own team. And also setting themselves up for like future success and staying in the good habits, because it really is about building good habits. And you know, not for nothing, Git is hard. Like, that was a pretty common theme throughout all of my Ice Age research, is that people find it just, you know, incredibly difficult to get onboarded on. And our research revealed a few different reasons for why that is. One of the main ones is that they just lacked a mental model for version control in general, which I thought was, you know, pretty interesting.
Yeah.
You know, it's difficult to think, remember the staging area when you just are used to control S.
I know when I use Git, I have a cheat sheet on my computer that I reference to tell me the steps that I do in order to get things. Because if you only use Git, you know, once every couple of months, or maybe even sometimes once every 6 months, then it doesn't become habitual the way that it is for a lot of programmers. And we talked about this a little bit in a previous episode, but we kind of streamlined that process for my dissertation by using Git Annex. And we chose that for a couple of reasons. One of the main ones is because my dissertation is in the field of art history and archaeology, which means that my dissertation has 118, I think, images, and you just can't store large files in Git very easily.
Yeah, it's a huge problem. And also for reproducibility purposes, you know, a lot of the folks in Ice Age expressed that it was also hard to even connect external data sources to GitHub repositories in a way that like makes sense. Mm-hmm. And also that Git LFS is just really hard to use.
Yeah. So Git Annex makes it a little bit easier because we have it set up so that it just automatically saves changes. So
yeah.
That I don't have to actively think about it. I can just write my dissertation and there's version control happening without me actively thinking about it. And I know we talked with Joey Hess, the main developer and maintainer for Git Annex, about a year ago, and said that I was the only person he knew of that was using Git Annex for a dissertation. But I feel like it could be useful more broadly applied in academia.
Absolutely. I also think it's interesting too, in our survey data, most of the people who learned Git learned it from books and the manual, which would preclude them even discovering, I think, Git Annex or other like Git related tools that could be helpful to them. So I also think there's some teaching and learning stuff to be done in that space.
Yeah, and I think that really the only reason that I came to know about it is because I am an academic who lives with a free software developer.
Yeah,
and
me
was
too.
Able to say, oh, there's an easy thing that you can use. But if other academics don't know how or where to find these things, then they just don't get used.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I feel like we've talked a lot about free software as in terms of its connection to open research and stuff like that, But when I go to your webpage, there's just so many things on here. Some of it, I think, about your interests in academic research and your interests around crafts and so on. I would like to explore some of those other areas. So would you like to indulge us with some of your areas of either, if you had all the free time in the world to do some sort of academic writing, or if you know, what kind of crafting you do, just please indulge ourselves and our listeners with some of those other areas.
Yeah, absolutely. So I've been thinking about this a lot lately, which is things that I really want to study or write up, but I don't have the time to do right now. And I think the top of the list would be actually doing some ethnographies of game developers who have developed like whole games by themselves. So that's like Concerned Ape for Stardew Valley, the guy who developed Roller Coaster Tycoon, whose first name is John and last name is escaping me. So I'm really just interested in the folks who take on these like big creative endeavors, and also then the community that sprouts around them, because ethnographies are not just interested in, like, you know, me interviewing Concerned Ape and hearing the perspective. It's also, what's the community impact? How has the community arisen around things like Stardew Valley, which, you know, has a lot of really cute crossovers into lots of different areas that I care about, like open source software, but also like crafting. So some of my general interests in crafting, I've been crafting forever, as I said, and I always come back to embroidery. It was the first craft I learned and one of my favorite to this day. But I also am a huge knitter. So I like to knit different data visualizations. Like I knit a weather blanket of the year 2017. And then also just fun stuff. Like I knit a tie for one of my friends once. And I drift towards the things that are programming-esque. There's actually a great article called Why Knitting Was the First Programming Language, or something like that. So I seem to stay in the same area, even though it takes lots of different forms.
I feel like knitting data visualizations is the perfect Foss and Crafts topic, right? Because it incorporates your craft hobby practices with kind of more broadly what you do on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's also just like a fun outlet. Like I'm not the best at like necessarily generating unique creations by myself, but I love to find like interesting patterns for cross stitch or for knitting and taking them on. Like for Stardew Valley, I bought a cross stitch kit that had like all the Jimino huts and all the different colored Jiminos, because they have specific shading and stuff, and I'm a huge nerd for Stardew Valley. So I've been cross stitching like endless Jiminos and Jimino huts, and it's just so cute. But it is just like the ones and zeros. No, like it's all just pixels. I'm just stitching pixels together.
Which cross stitch or knitting or embroidery, like doing pixel art is really easy in those things because you're basically just putting together blocks of things. We were playing another proprietary game recently that allows you to do some craft things in it. And I was making a pattern and Chris comes up and is like, you know that you're doing pixel art right now. And I'm like, excuse me, I'm just putting an actual knitting pattern into this to make a pattern.
Yeah, it is like funnily the same. I think about that a lot. I also think of like going back to your question about the, you know, the research I would do if I had all the time in the world. I really think there is I am really interested in exploring like the history of gender in a given industry, and particularly like the loom and crafting industry, and as well as computer science, because there are so many similarities between like female dominated fields that are then sort of like swapped in terms of the majority representation. yeah. like computer science.
I don't know if you're aware, but my dissertation is on women in textile production in the Roman Empire. Exactly. So like that's exactly what I study is.
And that is exactly what I would do if I didn't already have a full-time job and doing a second master's. It's so interesting to me.
Sorry, Morgan, why don't you follow up on that? I've got something too, but that's so relevant to your stuff. So go ahead.
Yeah, and one of the main things that I discuss in my dissertation, I'm looking at the Roman Empire in particular, and there's all of these sources that talk about the kind of like broader global trade networks of the Roman Empire, and it's more like not industrial because that doesn't happen at this point yet, but like more industrialized than before, and therefore more male-centric. And my dissertation is looking at how women's roles continue within this kind of more masculine-dominated field.
Please publish that openly and send me the link.
it will be. I'm so close to done.
That's good. I'm so excited. That sounds awesome.
Thank you.
If there's more, actually, I know there's more things to be said in the textile area because I have a feeling.
Well, we do this regularly, but that's at least two other episodes that we've already got planned because we're going to do one on my dissertation eventually, like an entire episode on it, and we're going to do one on how weaving influenced early
programming. So. Yes, and we're doing the thing again. We're previewing the episodes that don't exist yet. A bad podcast form. But I do have something that you said that grabbed me in a couple of ways. So, you mentioned your interest in a well-known game that I also enjoy, Stardew Valley, and I'm sure it will not be lost on some listeners like, oh, wait a minute, this is proprietary, right? And actually, I do wish Stardew Valley was not proprietary. The closest thing we have, I think, is Cataclysm Dark Days Ahead, and you just turn off all the zombies and then just start on a farm. But we don't really have anything else like it in the free software world. But I think there's also something interesting there as in terms of things maybe the free software community can learn from something specific that you mentioned, which is the modding culture around Stardew Valley. So I wonder if you'd be interested in fleshing out, maybe especially for the listeners who are not familiar with modding culture around games. There is modding culture around some free software games. Actually, Cataclysm DDA is a great example. But I think modding is most famously well known within a lot of larger proprietary games. And the cultural overlaps between that and FOSS can be kind of interesting. And maybe there are even some pieces to pick up and try to observe ourselves. So would you like to give an introduction to what that means and kind of what's available and what the community is doing in terms of the modding that you're seeing?
Yeah, specifically in Stardew Valley?
Yes.
Yeah, so modding is actually pretty front and center in Stardew Valley. Like it has a page on the official or on the fan wiki rather. There's a whole player guide and you can mod things on Android, Linux, Mac, or Windows, which I think is really neat. They describe the actual like technical processes in a really, I think, wonderful, clear, and I don't want to say like explain to me like I'm five, but really plain language. Like there's not a lot of jargon around the mechanics of modding, especially in a lot of their like documentation where they're trying to onboard new players and get people to use mods. So I think there's a lot about the actual technical writing around the modding community in Stardew Valley that I think would be really awesome to see bridged. There are quite a few folks I know who study open source documentation and who writes it. And like Stuart Geiger, for example, at UC Berkeley, wrote a great paper about, the challenges, I'll just say, around documenting open source. So I actually think that's one area that is almost a direct connection or a direct inspiration. Like they audience for Stardew Valley is, definitely a certain age group, right? And so they definitely have adapted a lot of, you know, what is extremely technical work, boil down into really sort of what people need to know to get going. And as a result, mods are really heavily used. They have multiple popular modding websites for Stardew Valley that are linked from that wiki. People have gists on GitHub that explain their favorite mods and why. And I especially like the ones that point to mods that improve the game while maintaining like the balance and the lore, because I am a huge video game lore nerd specifically. Like, I love the world building part of it. So I often look for that.
Well, you said that you didn't want to say, don't explain it to me like a 5-year-old. But on the other hand, that's one of the things about doing things like mods or you know, HTML editing in video games or something like that, is that you do have 5-year-olds doing it, right? Maybe not 5, but you have kids learning how to do kind of like basic fundamental things, fundamentals of programming or development or something like that, because it's a video game and they want their Stardew Valley to be customizable, right?
Absolutely. And it's everything from like, there's a mod to just make pineapples appear everywhere, and there's not even pineapples in just like stock Stardew Valley. But yeah. there's also a whole mod that just spans the Stardew Valley universe. So it's called Stardew Valley Extended. It adds like over 20 locations. Like, it's a really almost like huge DLC to the game. Mm-hmm. So there's lots of different interesting levels of participation and just like play and funness that happens that I think is also just really, I love observing that. Like, the thing that it gets me about the Stardew Valley community is just the joy.
Mm-hmm.
So I think for those of our listeners who might have never participated in a modding type community before, you mentioned a couple of things like, you know, the pineapples and stuff like that. But what are some other things? Like, why might somebody feel motivated to make a mod? What do you think the motivation is for that? And Morgan mentioned, you know, it's popular with kids. Minecraft is also actually increasingly being used to teach kids at to learn programming and stuff like that. Like, what has gotten out of either using a mod, and can you give some other examples, and what do you think has gotten out of making a mod?
So I think what you get out of using a mod is actually the importance of community sharing. So you're downloading something that someone else has made. Most of the mods, most, if not all, the mods in Stardew Valley are open source. So you're actually like, it's almost introducing people to open source in some ways. And I think that's really compelling. You're like, this game, you know, it is proprietary, and I hope in my heart of hearts concerned it will make it open at a certain point in its life cycle. But often what you gain from, like, you know, someone who's a bit younger using a mod is an introduction to free software. And also the idea of like freedom to modify a software that you have bought. Like, that's a pretty key tenet of, like, you know, free software is, you know, I remember learning about free software in my first degree, which was computer science. And we watched like a video on the history of open source, and someone had said in an interview for that tape, why would you buy a house and not be able to paint the walls? And likened that to buying software and not being able to do anything. And modding is almost exactly that. It is buying a piece of software and then painting the walls. You're not doing it on a fundamental level, but you're doing it on a level that still impacts your experience. And I think that's really cool. What you gain from contributing, I think, is what people gain from open source and a strong community in general, right? Like, you're making something other people enjoy. You're making something you enjoy. You're making something that, you know, will also be taken up by different community members. Like, the Stardew Valley community is really good about transfer of mods. So if someone is done maintaining something, you will typically find somebody else who will pick it up. And that, I think, is really cool and points to how good that community is.
And I think that that's something that a lot of kind of like hobby communities have, and free software also has, where you have communities just picking up a project after they are discontinued by their main thing, but you don't have that necessarily in, say, academia or more kind of professional software development environments.
Absolutely. There is a lot of knowledge transfer problems and memory problems in academia, especially around software. Folks either really take two approaches, I found, which is never upgrading their system. Like, I have a friend who did a PhD in climate science, and she had to use Fortran because that's what her advisor used, and that's what all their previous analysis work was based on. So she had to sort of pick up and use the legacy system, or they burn it and redo it pretty much every time they have to do a task. So it's definitely tough.
In the digital humanities project that I was already talking about it, my advisor handed me a printout of code that she wrote in DBase when she was doing her dissertation, because she thought it might be helpful for me. And I'm like, I'm gonna stick with Python, but thank you.
Yeah, it's like that PhD this comic.
Yeah, and then also, so I built a website using Python, and it's a static website, and then someone in the university was like, oh no, you should be using Drupal. So the professor decided to switch it to Drupal. And then someone's like, oh no, Drupal is too complicated. And the support staff that we promised you are no longer here. So then we switched it to WordPress, and that because she wanted to have a dynamic site. And then it was switched to, the final one was to Airtable. So like,
wow.
In one project, we have both of those things, right? Yeah. The kind of like legacy code that's hard to incorporate, but it's there and you don't want to just ignore it. But also the trying to just keep up with whatever is the new cool thing.
Yeah, sustainability is just a big problem. And especially for like digital preservation work, it is particularly hard when you think of things like file format obsolescence, and in the case of software, you know, like OS degradation, like on a very low level system, systems that just can't be run on modern computers. It gets complicated very fast.
Yep.
So there are a couple of things I wanted to kind of tie back in with the modding stuff, because I think there's a lot to celebrate and learn from modding things, but I think it's also worth recognizing the maybe the boundary of enthusiasm that, like, I have a lot of enthusiasm when I see the kind of community energy around mods, but then I also sometimes get slapped in the face where I remember, oh right, and this is the real danger zone. So like, there are a couple of projects that I thought have been really cool that have gotten, whenever you're doing something along the lines of modding or a fan work of these kinds, you're kind of right now, Concerned Ape is being fairly nice about its community being able to mod, right? But every now and then you have this time where it seems like, okay, we're going through this period where we're not getting in trouble, and we're being generally, you know, maybe even kind of a low key level of support, but then it just kind of get the rug gets pulled out from you, right? So a good example of this, I think, maybe is there's two things I think about. One is Project M, which is basically the Smash Brothers community decided to continue an older version of the game by patching it as kind of a open source project, basically, and called Project M. And they continued the development long after the proprietary game was originally made. And that's cool that like it's continued to be developed in that way. And there's another game called, I think, AM2R, another Metroid 2 remake, which is in general considered one of the best quote-unquote Metroid games that's ever been made. But the problem is that both of these projects appeared to be, you know, like, you know, they had an enthusiastic community that was continuing for a long time, and both of them ended and mentioned that it was legal threats and takedown notices that basically stopped the project. So that's the sad part.
Yes.
Of modding with the, yeah.
That's the nail on the head, which is like the hardest part of preservation or memory work, the hardest part. Which is like also, I think a lot of these folks picked up those games in service of keeping them around longer, which is great.
Yes.
But the biggest threat to software preservation is copyright. Actually, archiving, the act of archiving software, is not protected under fair use in the United States. And so it stymies a lot of actual just straight up preservation work from even an institutional standpoint. From an individual standpoint, it gets a lot dicier because, you know, you're an individual and it's Nintendo or whoever coming after you, and that's extremely scary. But the way copyright right now works in the United States, it's pretty much, you know, guaranteed that a lot of software will just cease to exist, frankly.
And
it's because of strict copyright.
And anyone trying to preserve history is doing so at legal risk.
Absolutely. Yes. Especially around software.
Yeah.
And there's like a few court cases right now that we've been keeping our eye on. There's a great, I'll give a shout out to the Software Preservation Network, which is a membership organization within library and information science dedicated to software preservation, as the name suggests. And they have a whole legal side of their work where they, for instance, will write like amicus briefs for Supreme Court cases, including Google versus Oracle, things like that, which would impact archiving in a big way. So I would definitely give them a shout out and say, like, it's definitely a huge area of impact, the work around loosening copyright specifically for software.
Mm-hmm.
But it affects everything, too. Like, it affects data. It affects manuscripts. The fact that people can't share their work openly is usually because they've signed away their copyright to a publisher. There are lots of embedded issues within that. But it's the same for, like, the modding communities getting the rug pulled out from under them. It is a straight-up a copyright issue.
I think I had one follow-up to that, which was about the academic publishing, that either you've already sold the copyright to an academic publisher, or if you release it in an open format before you publish it, then you won't be able to publish it with an academic publisher because they won't be able to control the copyright. So that's one of the reasons that people are afraid to publish.
You can still publish with them, but you just can't transfer the copyright because you've already established a license.
But I've definitely heard people voice the fear that if you release it open in an open context, then you won't be able to release it or you won't be able to get it published by a publisher, because academic publisher, because they won't want it if they can't have copyright.
Well, I think, you know, big academic publishers benefit from open licenses as well, simply because they have redistribution rights already baked in. They can still, like, in a lot of cases, resell things, depending on the particular license used for a piece. There's also that often the copy of the manuscript that you're depositing into, like, a preprint repository or your institutional repository or a disciplinary one is often not the same version that's going for publication. It's usually the pre-peer review version. So there are often substantive enough changes that folks are generally okay. There's actually a great website called Sherpa Romeo that you can type in the name of a publisher and it will tell you, yes, you can publish this open immediately, no matter where, or the publisher says you have to wait a year, which a lot of publishers say you have to wait a year before you can make a copy openly available. So Sherpa Romeo, it tells you all the journal policies. It's really useful for that. But there are definitely ways to publish openly first and then, you know, still publish with a publisher. But I definitely have heard that fear before as well.
Yeah.
So I actually think, you know, we talked a lot about how when you kind of start with, let's say, a either cultural or software based, not kind of non-free base, right? You know, you've either got some cultural work that you're working off of or some software work. And in the case of games, it's both, right? You know, you've got both culture and software there at the same time. So that makes it a particularly interesting case that derivative works effectively are subject to kind of the whims of the original source material to some degree. If you don't figure out how to file off all of the original, serial numbers, basically, and kind of remove it from that restriction. So if you, in those scenarios, we sometimes do, I mean, we often do see takedowns and stuff like that, and that can be really sad. But I think there's actually room, even within those moments that seem really negative, that we can maybe actually even capture something positive, which is the efforts of explaining and writing up when something like that is so upsetting and disappointing can be a lesson, right, about the way that our copyright systems work, I think. You know, one of my biggest introductions as to why free and open source software was really important was I played a massively multiplayer game back in the late 90s, early 2000s that allowed anyone to be able to extend it. And it did get a takedown notice. And a couple of my friends who were running an older version of software, once they decided they didn't want community servers anymore, did start getting takedown notices. And that made me feel like, oh, you know, this is really important. So maybe I'm going off in a weird direction, but I actually feel like that can be positive. Like, if you get people to become aware through those experiences, I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, you know, I think we can either contribute or disrupt the corporate capture of scholarship and the corporate capture of the arts, which I include video game as an art, of course. So mm-hmm. I think, yeah, we can. I often will tell people, like in talks when I'm sort of going off on copyright, I'll say like it starts in the mirror. And there's also many support people around you that can help you. Like, if not your friendly librarian at whatever institution you're at, your public librarian, there is support for you in not only getting information about copyright and how it affects your use of material, but also how you can effectively license and copyright your own work. So I would say there's lots of good support systems that people can definitely take advantage of. I've also seen communities sort of come up with their own interesting licensing structures. Like there's a whole thing I just discovered about open source licenses for cannabis strains that is so fascinating to me. So I love anything that galvanizes community understanding. And I would just say, as your friendly librarian on the podcast, all the listeners should go find your own friendly librarian and they will likely be able to help you.
Awesome.
So there's my call to action, and it starts in the mirror.
Perfect.
So practice what you preach.
Yeah. I would also like to add on to what Chris said with that massively multiplayer online game sending takedown notices. Years and years and years after that, Chris, what did it lead you to do?
Oh, right. That's actually led to the Sprightly project, my very work. I mean, it's actually been
there's stepping stones along the way, because there was Liberated Pixel Cup.
Yeah, you could see that moment as being, you know, it's false to construct a narrative where you say, and then this one moment led to all those things, because of course there were a lot of things that happened. But it was definitely an experience that pushed so many other things forward, both feeling that potential of, oh my gosh, me and my friends are all extending this thing. It's all been taken away from us, right? And, you know, you can see that influencing all the work that I did from there. Stuff on network freedom, the Liberated Pixel Cup, the artwork style is directly influenced by that game, which was called Grail Online, and which itself was originally called Zelda Online, which got a takedown from Nintendo, so they rebranded.
Wow.
Right? And then they later on sent their own takedown notices against other people, right? And so that moved me to, you know, both being interested in network freedom and also the very things that I'm doing with Sprightly and why you see virtual worlds appear as one of the goals in Sprightly is, you know, I believe, you know, just what you were saying, Vicky, about the exciting capacity to see, you know, young people get engaged in programming, but also, gosh, I want to have, you know, digital art spaces of digital artistic collaboration where it's safe legally for everyone to contribute. So yeah, I think you're right, Morgan. That's I guess I'm personally,
Chris,
an example
and
of that.
Did you get
your career is the shining beacon?
No, oh, that's taken too far.
I was gonna say too, I take inspiration from a lot of that. Like, did we actually meet in the Pepper and Carrot community? Because I love Pepper and Carrot so much, and I think it's just such a shining example of the joy and community around open art. And so
Sprightly's, if you go to sprightlyproject.org, all the character art on there is done by David Rovois, the Pepper and Carrot.
Yeah, when
artist.
I saw it, that's what I immediately thought of, and I was like, he must have gotten DeVue for this.
Yeah.
I love it. And it is just like, I take such inspiration from, and also the thing I love too is just the learning opportunity. Like, it's so cool to see, like, David does these blog posts that are great about his in-depth process of using, like, Krita and open source software. It's just, I take such inspiration from that, and I, like, want to apply that to academia and to my work as well. So I would say, too, like, another good call to action is just take inspiration and go for it.
Yes. Oh, okay. Well, that feels perfect. That's the high note we want to end on. We're all feeling charged up and inspired.
Yes.
Vicky, it's been great having you on the show. I'm sure we could probably do another 10 of these with the, like, we only kind of touched the surface level of.
We didn't even talk about tabletop games.
Oh, we didn't even talk about
tabletop games. Which I love so much.
So, yeah.
As do we.
There's so much that we can talk about here. But I think we've hit a good wrap-up point for the episode. So I suggest we do that now. Vicky, thank you for coming on the show. If there are people who are excited by your work and your thoughts, where can they find and reach you?
Yeah, so I'm everywhere at Vicky Steves on the Fedi at Vicky Steves at Auckland.social. And every other social media, it's just Vicky Steves, all one word. So definitely get in touch with me if you're interested in anything we talked about.
Excellent.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you both.
We had a lot of fun with this episode.
Yeah, same.
Foss and Crafts is released under the Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 4.0 International License.
It's hosted by Morgan Lemmerweber and Christopher Lemmerweber.
The intro music is composed by Christopher Lemmerweber, meaning myself, and Milky Tracker, and is released under the same license as the show.
The outro music is Enchanted Tiki 86, composed by Alex Smith of the Cynic Project, and is waived into the public domain under CC0 1.0. See cynicmusic.com for more information.
You can get in contact with us on the Fediverse, Foss and Crafts at octodon.social, on Twitter as @FossandCrafts, or you can email us, podcast@FossandCrafts.org.
We also have a chat room. Join our community, #FossandCrafts, on irc.freenode.net.
If you'd like to support the show, you can donate at patreon.com/CWEBBER.
That's it for this week.
Until next time, stay free
and stay crafty.
All right. Well, I think actually maybe that was just.
Yeah, I think that was just the end. I don't think we need to do the awkward byes.
That was the end. All right. Bye, everybody.
Okay. Now we can stop recording.
Yes.
Okay.